So, okay, so this morning we have Rob Sajet, who's the Director of Water Quality at Harare Environmental Consultants in Seattle. And he's worked on water quality and aquatic science project for the last 19 years. He received a Bachelor of Environmental Biology from the University of Calgary in 1978 and a Master's in Water Resources Management from the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering in 1981. And he's been a consultant since, graduated from the University of Washington. He's focused on lake restoration, aquatic plant management, contaminated sediment remediation, non-point source pollution characterization, and stormwater management. And he conducted his first microbial source tracking study in 1980 at Pipers Creek in Parkley Park, over by the south, and has conducted approximately 10 MSD studies since then, and is currently conducting the second MSD study at Pipers Creek. But today, we're going to hear about Green Lake Algal Treatment, dose for a decade.
That was my bio from last year when I did a microbial source tracking study presentation, but I have done a lot of lake work too. Here we go. All right, well, good morning. I'm here to tell you about Green Lake. Hopefully you all know where that is, and I'll show you if you don't. I'd like to thank the following people for their support in this project. Kevin Stoops, who is now the assistant superintendent of Seattle Parks and Recreation, has been a long supporter of Green Lake and has... Should I put the mic on? Maybe.
Ask the people if they can hear you.
Can you hear me back there all right?
No.
No. Okay. And, all right. And how's that? Kevin, still to this day, still goes out in the boat and collects samples, as he has for 20 years, and was able, that was a big reason why we got the funding for this alum treatment. Dr. Harry Givens and Dr. Gene Welch helped me on the project. I've worked back with Gene. He was my major professor when I did my graduate research on Pine Lake back in 1980 here at UW. And Rebecca Dugopolsky, who did her graduate research on the alum treatment of Green Lake and provided some of the sediment core analysis that I'll be presenting here today. And we have since hired her at Herrera. Sally Abella at King County has been a big factor. She's now leading the, they call the Lake Stewardship Program at King County, that provides education and monies for citizens to monitor lakes. Now Green Lake is fortunate to have a good data set that we're able to evaluate the effectiveness of the alum treatment because that wasn't really being done to the extent that it needed to be by the Parks Department. And lastly, the Friends of Green Lake, they're really, it's a small citizens group. I go to their monthly meetings. They're very supportive, of course, of water quality. That's their focus, water quality of Green Lake. And they were the one that really got the mayor to put out $1 million for this, to get this job done. And so by a citizen's action on their part. So today I'm going to go through a little bit of background of the lake, the watershed, some of the historical problems and early solutions. Then I'll talk about the alum treatment in 91. So Green Lake's had actually two alum treatments, one in 1991, and then we did it again in 2004. I'll talk about how those treatments went. Then we'll look at some data, how effective it's been. It's been now, well, we'll look at the effectiveness of both those alum treatments, but it's been about 4 years of data we have since the 2004 alum treatment. And then I'll have some time. I'll talk about some of the stormwater and sediment studies that we did. Follow-up of the alum treatment to help understand the longevity, to assess the longevity of the alum treatment. Here's the watershed. It's urban, completely developed. The dashed line is the watershed boundary. This big basin represents most of the drainage area, is the Densmore Basin, but it contributes less than 50% of the stormwater that flows into the lake. Why? Because most of the stormwater that drains down, this is like the I-99 highway corridor, down to the lake, bypasses into a stormwater pipe up here to a pump that goes down to Lake Union. The only water that gets into Green Lake is under maximum flow conditions in the pipe, and it jumps a weir and then goes into the lake. So only under extreme storm events, large storm events, does water actually drain from this basin into it. And none of this is treated. This is just urban storm water with no real water quality treatment. So the rest of the storm water is in these other two basins, which we call the nearshore basin, which is just inside the roadway area and drains the grass parkland area. And then the Woodland Park Basin, which is where the ball fields are and Woodland Park. And that's where we did our stormwater study that I'm going to talk about later, was looking at phosphorus sources in this small little basin, which turns out to contribute a large amount of nutrients to the lake. What you don't see is what the natural drainage basin used to be to Green Lake. Much of this area to the west and this area to the east used to drain to Green Lake, but has been diverted into a combined sewer system. So it now the stormwater that rainfall that falls onto the land and that surface there actually goes down to the West Point treatment plant into the combined sewer system. So in the end, we have a lot of natural drainage diverted away from the lake, and a large percentage of the stormwater coming from a very small area. This is the lake with some bathymetric contours and meters. It's a shallow lake. It's a small shallow lake. Its average depth is about 15 feet across the middle of the lake. Perfect habitat for aquatic plant growth. And it does have a deep hole down in the northeast corner. That's the index monitoring station. That's where we do our temperature depth profiles to look whether the lake is stratified. And these are the other sampling, composite A, composite B. Historically, that's where we've collected samples as a whole water composite sample, combined the two and analyzed it for nutrients and chlorophyll and those things. We've also taken sediment cores at these two locations, the index and composite A, which I'll refer to later. And more recently, after the 2004 album treatment, we took cores actually at all four locations. These areas outlined in A are really... outlined in red are the active drainages to the lake. These city water inputs really no longer exist. There still is a city water input up here, and this is inflow from the Roosevelt and Maple Leaf reservoirs up in that part of Seattle where they drain the drinking water reservoirs into the lake. Historically, they did it to flush the lake regularly. Now they only put that city water in when they need to clean the reservoirs a couple times a year. So it's not a very much amount of water. There's lots of outflows, but the only one that's really acting is right up here at the northeast end. And this one then, so this water discharges out here and flows into the same stormwater pipe that goes to Lake Union. So in essence, Green Lake drains to Lake Union. There is a little bit of seepage through the weir at this outflow location, I understand, and that goes into the combined sewer system. So here again, we got the Densmore drain up here, and maybe some of you have seen the big 7-foot by 7-foot box culvert out in the shore there. And then there's a couple of drains, the Woodland Park drain north and the Woodland Park drain south, which is a newer drain that replaced the old Woodland Park drain more recently. So, Green Lake's been green since 1916, and it's a eutrophic lake. It always has been, and they dredged it early on to try and deepen it, but it's always stayed green. It's had blue-green algae or cyanobacteria blooms historically, and odor problems for many, many years. We just more recently know that those blooms actually produce toxins that are toxic to mammals and humans that consume water. It has this high internal phosphorus load where a lot of the nutrients are actually being released from the sediment. So the historical deposition of nutrients that inflow from the watershed, settle to the bottom, and then the recycling of those nutrients back up into the water column creates the major source of nutrients for the algae that are growing in the lake. But large waterfowl populations, early studies have shown, contributed a large amount of the nutrient load also. And again, it has a lack of natural drainage, which is, and that drainage which does come into the lake is polluted. And then, of course, in the 1980s, Eurasian water milfoil invaded the lake and created a whole another set of problems, which we won't be addressing here, but I'll try to touch on it. So, as I mentioned earlier, historically, dilution was the solution to pollution. But let's pump that clean drinking water through the lake and keep Green Lake blue. And that worked. But the price of water increased with increasing prices of water. It doesn't become an economic feasible option. I put in here dredging nutrient-rich sediments as a solution. It really wasn't. They dredged it to deepen it to provide more boating habitat. But dredging has been used as a removal of nutrient-rich sediment to reduce internal loading. We don't think it probably had a significant effect in Green Lake, but it may have helped improve the water quality of the lake. So back in 1981, UW, just as I was leaving, I didn't get to work on this project. I was working on Pine Lake, but Mike Perkins did the research on Green Lake and his graduate students. It wasn't Mike. And did a water balance and nutrient balance of the lake and confirmed, yes, like most other lakes, phosphorus is the limiting nutrient. What does that mean? That just means of the carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus, primarily looking at the ratio that those elements exist in the water as they are available for algal growth, the ratio is very low for phosphorus, and that becomes the limiting nutrient. The first thing that gets used up by the algae is the phosphorus. So every time you add more phosphorus, that's going to stimulate more algae growth. And secondly, that much of that phosphorus was from this internal loading. And how does internal loading happen? Historically, internal loading wasn't seen as a very prominent source of phosphorus in shallow lakes because they're oxygenated. Historically, it's been the deep anoxic hypolimnia of lakes. When the oxygen goes out in the lake, most of the phosphorus is bound to iron, and the iron transform into an anoxic state from ferric to ferrous and releases the phosphorus. So the phosphorus becomes soluble under anoxic conditions, and that's where it migrates up into the water column. But actually, we're finding more and more in these shallow lakes that in very nutrient-enriched shallow lakes that the sediments are anoxic. Even though the water above them has oxygen in them, there's so much microbial growth and decomposition that the reducing conditions in the sediment form, and phosphorus is being released in shallow lakes. And in fact, in Green Lake, it accounts for 20% of the annual load to the lake. And in the summertime, when the algae are growing, 88%. So clearly a big deal. What does that mean? Well, you can put all the stormwater management controls you want in the watershed, but you're still going to have this reservoir of phosphorus cycling up and feeding the algae all along. And that's happened in a lot of lakes where they've gone in and cleaned up the watersheds, done stormwater treatment, and yet lakes continue to be enriched. And that's because of this internal cycling process. So they looked for alternative sources, as I said, because of the high cost of drinking water. So the first thing they looked in at was groundwater. Can we pump groundwater from around the region and put it in the lake? Well, it turns out there's a lot of phosphorus in the groundwater in this region, as there is in much of Western Washington. So that wouldn't have worked. It's just been pumping in more phosphorus from the groundwater. Then the next one was to build a pipeline up from Union Bay in Lake Washington and dilute it with Lake Washington water. And that actually turned out to be cost feasible, I guess, but they couldn't get the permit. It's a water rights issue. And so that kind of put the whole plans for that dead in the water, so to speak. Then they actually started designing a treatment plant, a regular conventional drinking water treatment right down by the boathouse. It sucked water in, flocculate it with alum, settle it out, and spit it back out into the lake, circulate it in and out. But clearly, when they started penciling it out, it got to be way too expensive. So they came up with alum. Alum is a very cost-effective tool for lakes that suffer from nutrient enrichment, primarily from the sediments. There are other techniques out there. I haven't gone through the entire list. I mentioned dredging earlier as one, but that always becomes more costly. Dealing with sediment is a very expensive process just because it's such a mess to deal with, and having to dry it and transport it and all that stuff. So that's always a very expensive process, and it's very difficult to predict because how deep to dredge and what. There haven't been very many successful dredging projects as a result. There is other chemicals you can use besides aluminum sulfate. Now, I'll mention aluminum sulfate, it's binding the phosphorus with the aluminum. So instead of phosphorus binding and releasing from iron, aluminum forms a very solid, almost permanent bound to the phosphorus. So it inactivates the phosphorus right in place. But you can also add iron chloride. That's been being used a lot in Canada now. They think that it's a more natural way of, and it's basically oversupplying the iron to bind with the phosphorus. But that usually is done in conjunction with an aeration system or something that's going to provide a lot of oxygen to penetrate into the sediment so that you can get an oxygenated layer on the surface to prevent release. So in 1990, a formal restoration program was developed by the Parks Department. It came up with two simple goals. We don't want phosphorus as an average summer concentration to exceed this value of 30. We have since lowered that to a value of 25. 25, for one, is better in line with the aesthetic values that we want to achieve, as well as it turns out it's in line with the state's water quality standards of 25 is what's recommended for most lakes in Western Washington. And then the Secchi depth. The Secchi depth is basically a measure of transparency. It's an 8-inch disc that we drop in the water, and when we lose sight of it, that's the depth that the transparency is. So we want to be able to see a Secchi depth on average, at least 2.5 meters below the water surface. And those were the two restoration goals. The program was not just alum, although alum treatment was the primary component of the program. There was some stormwater treatment down along the southwest shoreline. They built some three filter trenches and some other facility and a couple of vaults down there, and diverted a little bit more water from the Densmore drain. Continued dilution was surplus city water, so whenever the city had this extra water, as I mentioned, when they cleaned the reservoirs, let's go ahead and flush that through the lake. Eurasian water milfoil had covered 85% of the lake surface by this time after the 1980s invasion, and within 10 years had occupied nearly the entire water surface. So came up, they bought a harvester that you may have seen parked out there. It's since been removed because the milfoils all died off, and that's, again, another story. But they controlled Eurasian water milfoil, controlled Canadian geese, starting through several different programs, egg addling with oil, to scaring, to actually joining in with the Department of Agriculture harvest program, where they harvest and euthanize the Canadian geese. And of course, public education and lake monitoring were an integral component. We were out on the lake explaining to people what alum was and what it does and how it won't hurt you. I mean, there were people concerned that they would get Alzheimer's because we're adding aluminum sulfate to the lake, so it was important to educate the problem and rest those fears of what alum is. I put in parentheses the tiger muskie plant and the grass carp plant. That really wasn't part of the restoration program. Those are a couple of things that happened more recently that may have affected the trophic status of Green Lake. Tiger muskie really were planted in just to satisfy fishermen, but the hope was they would eat some of the common carp. Common carp are a real problem in Green Lake. They stir up the sediment. They exacerbate this internal cycling program. They cycle phosphorus through their bodies as well, so they're little nutrient pumps as well. I don't think it worked, but then there was the grass carp. And actually, they did plant grass carp in 2001, and that was somewhat coincident with the decline of Eurasian water milfoil, which I will say, we don't really know why the milfoil died, because the milfoil was competing with the algae for light, and we had very dense algae blooms. And when you have a lot of thick algae growth, you get very little light penetration, and aquatic plants usually suffer. And I believe there's a combination there. Grass carp don't like milfoil, but that's all that was in the lake. So they'll eat whatever they can to survive. That wasn't a large number of grass carp for that size of lake. They intentionally planted it to not overdo it. Grass carp usually either work really and wipe everything out or don't seem to affect anything. And in this case, they may have wiped it out, but I'm not convinced. At any rate, let's go to alum. Okay, 1991. We decided to use liquid aluminum sulfate combining it with sodium aluminate, which is the buffer. Aluminum sulfate's an acid. And if we just put in that acid, we'll titrate out the alkalinity of the lake and cause acidic conditions. Under acidic conditions, aluminum is toxic. Aluminum is not toxic if the pH is above 6. But once it gets below 6, you can have some toxicity issues with aluminum. And we don't want, and other pH problems. Fish are very irritated by low pH. So the buffer is added in two parts alum to one part of sodium aluminate. We calculated the dose using an alkalinity method, just was using jar tests by titrating it in and in as much as we could get in to keep a pH above 6.0. Using those jar tests, we recommended a dose of 13.7 milligrams of aluminum per liter of lake. So looking at how many tons of aluminum sulfate and sodium aluminate, there's aluminum in both those compounds, looking at the total mass or volume of those liquids that were pumped in the back of the barge here in two different lines. It has two different tanks. Sodium aluminate is very caustic. Actually, it comes in boiling hot, and it's very dangerous to work with. And they have to keep it separate. If they mix it, as soon as it mixes, it creates an exothermic reaction, and it needs to be done right near the water surface. And it is. It's mixed right there. And actually, it was in this particular one, it was discharged out two separate pipes in the back of the barge that's being towed. At any rate, due to sort of economic shortfall, shall we say, we only ended up putting in about 66% of that 13.7. So remember that number, 8.6 milligrams per liter was put in 1991. What did we see? Well, we saw improved water quality. It's inevitable that alum will improve the water quality. It takes out the phosphorus right out of the water column, and you'll get beautiful, clear water. What really counts is how long is it going to last, you know? And we want it to last more than 3 years, and we barely got 3 years out of it. So it didn't really meet the goals, I think, that we had hoped for in the treatment. It did, gave us some relief for several years, but as you'll see later, the algae came back. And, of course, the milfoil loved it. Water cleared up, and they still get their nutrients from deep. They got very deep roots, and they're able to pull phosphorus out from deep within the sediment, and they took off like gangbusters, or it did. So by 1999, this is now 8 years later, we have this Phanazominon bloom on the lake. And Gene Jacoby at Seattle University was the first to start measuring this toxicity of algal blooms. And she measured up to 32 micrograms per liter of microcystin. Microcystin is probably the most common algal toxin It's produced by a number of blue-green algae species, but not all of them. Thanis omnium here is one of them that produces it, but it's actually, it comes from the Microcystis aeruginosa, which is named after, which is a primary producer of microcystin. But it's also important to note that not every organism produces it. You can have toxic blooms, some blooms that are toxic sometimes and not others, and we don't really understand what turns on that trigger, that toxicity trigger in algae. But at any rate, right now the state has set a guideline of 6 micrograms per liter to basically warn people that it's unsafe to recreate in lakes due to potential incidental intake of ingestion of the water below 6. So we had what we would call a toxic blooms. Went the wrong way. And actually by 2002, Seattle Parks closed the swimming beaches. They at that time established a criterion of 1 microgram per liter microcystin. That's what the World Health Organization had recommended for drinking water reservoirs. But they said, well, we didn't really have a recreational lake standard. Let's just use that one to be safe. And in fact, they measure it by taking the most concentrated scums along the shoreline. So it's not recognized that when we look at these microcystin concentrations, it's not as a whole lake average like we do when we look at nutrients. We're actually looking for toxic areas. And you know what we're worried about? We're worried about the dogs coming down to the water and drinking it. That's really, quite frankly, is the biggest issue. And there has been some dog deaths in Western Washington from these things. And they saw some pretty high concentrations in those algal scum samples. And of course, the milfoil dye, these are all milfoil fragments, and this is all the cyano phycopigments, pigments, all looking very colorful in green light. These are some of the algae. That's what I study for my research, so I like algae. I'm going to show you them. This is Anabaena circinalis. This is a microcystin producer. This is microcystin aeruginosus, this sort of globular stuff that doesn't have any shape to it. These hollow spheres is Voronichinia, which is not a microcystin producer. And Green Lake had them all. Quite mix of mini algae that go through different. Here's some more microcystins. And this is Green Lake, somewhat famous for its Gliotrichia. There's been several UW students that have researched Gliotrichia and its migration up off the bottom. It grows in these spherical colonies off the bottom sediments, soaking up all that phosphorus that's readily available, and then as it produces gas vacuoles, and that causes it to float up, and it becomes an internal loading pump where the algae's actually physically absorbing the phosphorus and pumping it up into the water column. It doesn't have, we haven't found out that it's toxic. We're finding new toxins every year, though, so we haven't found it to be toxic just yet, I don't believe. Okay, let's talk about the alum treatment. So Kevin Stoops called me up in 2003. He says, yeah, I got some money. This is really bad. Actually, the lake was so bad, they closed the lake. It smelled bad. People were stopping coming to it. I mean, as you know, it's the most popular park in Western Washington, and it just was pretty bad. So they found a little bit of money to do the study. Mostly what we did is let's review the alum literature. Let's relook at the way we calculated the dose. Let's calculate it, and we calculated it a new way, and I'm going to run through that real quick for you. Do some jar tests to confirm that mostly, rather than using jar tests not to determine a dose, using jar tests to determine that the dose that we think it needs will not impact water quality or create a toxic situation, and then write the specs and the cost estimate for a contractor to bid. And also, we had to do an integrated phosphorus management plan for a permit. Just recently, right before this happened, the Department of Ecology made alum treatment as requiring it as a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit, which is usually intended for stormwater. But they really had no way to permit alum treatment, so they didn't know where to stick it, and they kind of stuck it in their NPDES permit. And as a result, we had to create this long plan, which was fine, but it was mostly just a regurgitation of the 1990 restoration plan that goes through and looks at all the alternatives and decides what's the best way to manage phosphorus in the lake. So these are the three methods, the alkalinity method, which we used in 1991. Internal loading method isn't really used very often. But the sediment phosphorus method is really the way to go. And that's what we used here today, and this is what they're using in the Midwest. They do a lot of alum treatments in the Midwest, Midwestern lakes. So what do you need? to do the sediment phosphorus data, you need sediment phosphorus data. You need not just to know how much phosphorus is in there, but what kind, what state the phosphorus is in. This is sort of laid sideways with sediment depth coming across the bottom and my concentrations up there. So the kinds of phosphorus that we look at are labile phosphorus. That's just readily reactive, mostly orthophosphate, free reactive phosphorus. Iron-bound phosphorus, which is the one. And the two of those together are really what we're trying to target, alum, is to bind up those two. Aluminum, it's already existing bound phosphorus. Calcium is usually a big component. And then there's organic phosphorus, and that's the red line and circles. And that's a tough one. We don't really understand how much of that is available. Clearly, some of it is. It's just depending on how complex it is. Over the long term, microbes can break down that organic phosphorus. And so we usually add a little fudge factor to try to bind up some of that in the future. But what I want to see here is you see a very uniform concentrations down to 25 centimeters, which is not that deep. But that's about as deep as we need to go. Looking at a deeper core, that was in the shallow western part of the lake, looking down that deep hole, we do see higher concentrations of this iron-bound phosphorus. And as in all lakes, sediments focus down. They find their way down to this deep hole, and there is less oxygen, a little bit less oxygen down there. It had gone anoxic down in that deep hole historically. It isn't now since we've done the alum treatment. But so as such, there is a lot more iron-bound phosphorus down in that deep hole. And that's something we considered when we calculated the dose. We would like to add a little bit more alum to that deep hole because there's more phosphorus in those sediment. And the way we did that was by calculating the dose over as a concentration. So when I say we came up with a dose of 18 plus 6 here. So we came up with a dose of 18 to bind up the sediment. We added another 6 in there to bind the phosphorus that was in the water column. We came up with a dose of 24 milligrams of aluminum per liter. That's like three times the 8.6 that we put in 1991. And by putting it in as a water column average, you necessarily add, because you're adding aluminum and it's going down and blanketing the sediments and binding them. So in the deeper areas, you're effectively giving it a higher dose in the deeper areas. So just because it's based on depth and an aerial thing. So the way we calculated this 18 is we started with the mobile phosphorus, and we used an average concentration of 370 micrograms per gram of sediment. Then we said, okay, that's the concentration of phosphorus that we want to bind. Then we said we want to bind it over about 20 centimeters of depth. And then we assumed only a 10% binding efficiency because actually historically we found that you don't get you don't bind up every element of phosphorus with every element atom of aluminum that you put in. So historically, when we've gone back into lakes and looked at how much of that aluminum we bound out, we see about 10% happen. So that's what we plan for. So you end up putting in 10 times more than you expect that will bind up your phosphorus. And that's how we came up with our dose. We stuck with the 2-to-1 ratio. That seems to work really well to keep the water buffered. And then we proceeded to write the specifications. We specified to do it in January to March at that time because we thought milfoil would intercept much of the alum, and we wanted to get a nice spread out over the bottom. But it turned out a milfoil wasn't there. But we did it in March anyway, and that's a lot of tonnages. That was, over a dozen truckloads. And we had to get the sodium aluminate from Canada and the aluminum sulfate from Arkansas. And we had troubles. In fact, as it turned out, the sodium aluminate we had specced out, we couldn't get it across the border. We had troubles getting the trucks across the border. And finally we got it, and it wasn't exactly the right specification that we ordered, but we used it anyway. And I'll talk more about that later. But at any rate, the way that was put in was to, again, do this 24 milligrams per liter over the water column by adjusting the dose rate with water depth using echo sounding equipment and using GPS equipment to try and track straight lines and go back and forth and cover every square foot of the lake that's deeper than 5 feet. We didn't get in, didn't want to go into the shallow areas and stir that up. Estimated 21 days. It actually took only 15 days. We estimated $1.5 million, but they only cost $1 million. Part of that reason was the contractor underbid the sodium aluminate. As it turned out, he didn't. I don't know why. I can't remember exactly why he did, but he was about $500,000 less than what we had estimated for, or $300,000 there, and a couple other hundred he came in shorter. And that was really fortunate, and that's why we were able to do these other studies, if I have time to talk about it. It looks like I'm not, but it was really great because that freed up a lot of money to learn more about the effectiveness of the alum treatment than we had originally budgeted for. This is the barge in the 2001. This one is very similar to the previous one. Actually, I think it was the same company. This time, instead of towing it with a tugboat, they were towed it with a boat, a skiff on either side, and they combined the chemicals and put it out one pipe out the end, and there you see the flock going in into Green Lake. That niche skiff towing didn't quite work so well. They had trouble. One boat was bigger than the other, so they were kind of doing a little zigzagging. But eventually they figured it out and were able to cover the whole lake, and we had this nice little GPS dot every hour in the hour, and we were able to plot that out and show that we got reasonable coverage across the lake. But of course, you don't want to be dumping too much in at one spot. You want to get a good thorough mixing and an even coating as possible, which is what we were out there to try and make sure it happened. Hey, well, this is about what we saw in terms of water quality within the first 2 weeks of the alum treatment. So these are based on average concentrations collected at several stations. And during, we collected them on an hourly basis, so we collected a lot of data during the alum treatment. So let's look at pH. So 7.5, that's pretty neutral, right? We put in, we slowly decrease the pH from starting at 7.5 down to 6.8. So on average, we didn't get a pH less than 6.8, but it was a slow titration essentially as we added it. And again, we didn't expect that. We didn't expect really a significant decrease at all, but again, it was this sodium aluminate wasn't as strong as we had specced it for, so it wasn't quite as strong, and it did have a little bit of impact on pH, but not enough to stop the process or cause any harm. It stayed there after 2 days, but it had rebounded. Within a couple of weeks, your pH is back to normal again. Alkalinity, it drops too. The alkalinity is the buffering capacity of the water. It drops. It stayed low, and it still stayed low. So there's still some reactivity going on with the aluminum sulfate and sodium aluminate that's in the sediment. Aluminum popped up threefold a couple days after as total aluminum, and then dropped back to background conditions within 2 weeks. Dissolved aluminum, which is probably what's most important. The EPA's criteria for aluminum is 80 micrograms per liter. That's based on total aluminum, but it's recognized that it's mostly the dissolved aluminum that is probably toxic. It did bump up threefold a couple days after, and actually it kept going up. So we didn't ever see, we didn't even measure it after that to see whether that where that went after that. But it's still low. Phosphorus. Knocked that out, and it went back again. So within a couple of weeks, the phosphorus concentrations had cycled back up and reached an equilibrium that were no different. Remember, this is in April. I don't know if you remember. Maybe I didn't tell you. But we did the treatment in mid-April to early May. So the lake had not experienced any algal blooms. And, in fact, the chlorophyll was rather low at 5 micrograms per liter. We totally zapped it by pulling the algae out. Algae forms the aluminum sulfate forms a flock that takes the particles out with it, and started regrowth already within a couple of weeks. Our visibility, our transparency was right at, interestingly enough, right at our summer mean restoration goal, and it just went clear. It went, actually, it almost went turquoise. The lake, we could see the bottom of the lake. That's the bottom of the lake, 6.8 meters, and it went crystal clear during the treatment. and stayed there for a couple of days. But already, after a couple of weeks, we got algal growth and hence lower transparency. All right. So I want to, treatment effectiveness. We're going to talk about treatment effectiveness. These are the three trophic state parameters. These are what we look at for lakes. How much phosphorus, how much chlorophyll, and our succedaneous transparency. These are the three factors. And we look at them as summer average concentrations. We recognize in lakes that we're going to get spikes in growth of algae and all that. And we're not typically trying to control for these spikes in that. And we're looking more at a general trophic state and whether our average summer condition can meet some goal. However, with the microcystin blooms, we are now looking more at looking at maximum levels and such. But let's just look at the data here. So we're looking at total phosphorus concentrations. I put now together in box plots, box and whisker plots, total phosphorus concentrations in micrograms per liter, 0 to 90, and I've compiled some data sets in time. The box is the 25th to 75th percentile. The whiskers are the min and the max, and then the mean is the little blue square, and the blue line is our goal. So we want that blue square to be under 25. Well, back in 1981, the UW study, it was nowhere near that goal. But it turned out that they did get some data right before the 91 alum treatment, and it wasn't as bad as it was that year. Well, you know, things go up and down every year, and this happened to be a good year, I believe. But after the alum treatment, we did knock down the phosphorus down just below 20. So we've met the and this is like 2.5 years of data that I didn't get all the data in to do the box. I'm sorry, I just had the means and the ranges. So got that there. But by 95 to 2000, the reason I pulled that together, this is the Parks Department, kind of Kevin Stoops going out when he had time during the summer to get a sample. We didn't have a robust data set. We have, on that five-year period, only 18 samples in the summer. But you can see things had already creeped up. Unfortunately, we didn't get any data for phosphorus in 2003, the year before our alum treatment. But I know it was up around there based on the chlorophyll that you'll see next. But look at this. This is our result after the 2005 alum treatment. We've got incredibly low phosphorus concentrations. We don't even have maximum values hardly exceeding our goal. And we don't even see a trend going in any direction. So it's looking good. And, you know, this is suggest, well, we got 5 years for sure. And I'm running out of time, darn. So let me look at chlorophyll. Same thing, lots of chlorophyll before the treatment. We don't have a goal for it, but after the 91 treatment, we had very low algae growth. Then the algae growth increased here in that five-year period quite substantially. And then here we have the very low chlorophyll values since the treatment. Secchi depth. This is the one that we do have data for the year before the treatment. And we got a lot of algal growth that year before that alum treatment. You saw that secchi depth on average was like a half a meter. I mean, that shows how much growth was going on and likely how much phosphorus and chlorophyll was associated with that low secchi depth. What you didn't see was that we've met our secchi depth goal ever since the alum treatment was done. Wow. Maybe we should talk about our sediment study. Seems like I can't seem to get it to move. Oh, well, there's the secchi depth. And you can see that the water clarity, on average, is working around 3 meters. I mean, we're not going to keep that lake blue. It's still green, but it's in a state now that meets the human needs for recreation, and it also is still in a eutrophic state where it can support the biotic community that exists in it. You know, I see that I've run out of time, so I'm going to skip the sediment study. I will say, though, by looking at sediments after that, we were able to see that there's still a lot of aluminum out there in that lake that's going to continue to react with phosphorus. We have bound up a lot of that phosphorus, and we anticipate that, that alum treatment to continue to function for another 5 years. We also did do a stormwater study to look at phosphorus sources in the Woodland Park drainage, and we found some amazing things that I did want to share with you. And one of those was the this wood chip pile that was leaching 5 milligrams per liter of phosphorus into Green Lake. And it's not something that we recognized. It was a wood chip pile that the city has contractors dump available for residents to use. And it was sitting on an asphalt pad, essentially, and the water was leaching right through it. In fact, they even had a stream coming down the hillside up there, pushing water through it, and it was pumping phosphorus into the lake. So we were able to find that through the stormwater study and get rid of it. My other big issue are these dirt play fields. This dirty brown water flows directly into Green Lake. They had installed a sediment vault, but the sediment vault fills up within one or two storm events, and it's too small anyway to really detain any of this fine sediment that just blows right through it and right into the lake. So we're working on the Parks Department to convert these dirt fields into synthetic fields that create that include a sand under drain and actually incorporate some more stormwater treatment for the surrounding areas for the lake. And ultimately, we need to continue to control these external sources of phosphorus to enhance and protect the investment that we made in alum, because you can the cost effectiveness of alum treatment is only going to increase as the more of the external phosphorus that you can prevent from discharging into your
into your lake. Okay, so we have time for maybe a question or two. So, anybody have any questions?
I was involved in the early work to try and allow the alum treatment. I was very aware of the public worries about alum. What did you guys do in the time frame from the early treatment to the 2004? Was there any public outreach at that point that was really needed, or had
no? I think the work that was done for the
question.
To repeat the question. What kind of public outreach did we do for the alum treatments? For the first one, for 1991, we did a lot. And there was a lot of concern, a lot of articles in the paper, and people were very concerned. It's kind of funny. I think there was twofold. The lake gotten so bad that, you know, anybody that spoke up against it was, you know, shut, you know, put out. But the other thing was I like to think that the education, the work we did the decade before that, you know, the public was more educated, and so there wasn't as much outcry. And frankly, we didn't have a public involvement program. It was announced at the meetings. I shouldn't say that, but it wasn't like we created a formal thing like we did before. It was just informal education. Yeah.
One more question? Quick one.
Yeah, you mentioned the use of iron chloride in Canada to keep the phosphorus down in the sediments. Is that ferric or ferrous chloride that's used?
It's, I think it's ferrous chloride, but they actually look at other iron components too, but I think it's the ferrous chloride is most commonly used.
Thank you.
But I don't know for sure.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time, so thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.